It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at this time, in his 2010 campaign for governor, Scott Walker promised voters he'd balance the budget, shrink the size of government, and help people create jobs. Tomorrow, we begin a three-part series that looks at whether Governor Walker followed through on those promises. Join WPR's own Sean Johnson as he digs into the numbers, talks to the experts, and listens to what voters have to say. That's starting tomorrow here on Central Time.
Right now, smart gun technology is off to a bumpy start in the United States. Smart gun manufacturers like Armadix are offering a .22 caliber handgun that uses a radio frequency-enabled stopwatch to identify the authorized user so no one else can fire it.
But the smart gun technology isn't going over well with Second Amendment rights supporters, at least so far. Groups like the NRA and the National Shooting Sports Foundation question the reliability of the technology along with its political ramifications.
Adam Winkler joins us now. He's a professor of law at UCLA and the author of Gunfight, The Right to Bear Arms in America. Adam, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with the smart guns themselves. What do we know about how they work?
Well, the smart guns are an emerging technology that would make a firearm so that it's only useful by the person who owns the firearm. And there would be some way, either it would check your fingerprints, and the owner would have their fingerprints within the gun, and it would only fire if those fingerprints register. Some of the other technologies that have been talked about are the user wears a particular ring that would send a signal to the firearm so that the firearm would know that it could fire, or even the wrist rods that you mentioned a moment ago. So they're all providing some kind of usually biometrics or radio frequency identification to try to improve gun safety, to make sure that someone who's not the true owner of a gun can't get their hands on it and shoot a neighbor, a kid, or someone accidentally.
Can you give us a sense of how smart guns are doing elsewhere in the world, in Europe, for instance?
You know what? The technology is still being developed. There's not been much spread of these firearms yet. I think there will be increasing demand for these kinds of firearms in some circumstances. The real question is whether there'll be a big demand for these firearms in the United States of America. And a lot of gun owners who are strong proponents of the Second Amendment believe that this technology is dangerous and would be an amount to forsaking people's Second Amendment rights.
So when you say that a lot of gun rights supporters think that these guns are dangerous, what do you mean by that? What's dangerous about them?
Well, one they worry about is, for instance, the arms manufacturer you mentioned a moment ago that's got this firearm that's being put out on the market. They've already said that they would give the government the ability to use radio frequencies, some kind of pulse technology that would actually make the firearms all inoperable. And for Second Amendment people, they're very worried that they're going to be forced to have guns with the smart technology, and then the government, when it wants people to be disarmed, will just make sure that they can't fire those weapons and use them for self-defense. And, of course, that idea of gun confiscation by another means is one of the great fears that motivates many people in the gun rights community.
After the shootings at Newtown, President Obama called for the development of smart gun technology with an executive order. So it seems like an interesting time if this is something that at least this White House administration is pushing for, and yet gun rights supporters are pushing back against it. How do you expect that to play out?
Well, that's a battle that's been going on, I guess, now since Newtown, and it doesn't look like it's going to give way anytime soon. I do think one of the biggest issues that we have to recognize with the technology is that, you know, there's already about 320 million guns out there in circulation in America, and they don't have smart gun technology. So even if we were to mandate that new firearms include this technology, it would take a long time before the stockpile of firearms in America didn't include a whole lot of firearms that don't have this technology and that wouldn't be smart guns. There's always going to be quote-unquote stupid guns out there. So the effectiveness of this kind of gun control law can be limiting, but it might be something that gun owners who have children, for instance, might be really attracted to for this technology just as a consumer safety issue. I want to be able to have a gun in my home for self-defense, but I don't want my children to be able to get a hand on that gun, fire it, and kill someone by accident.
But right now it seems as though it's going to be hard for that person to buy one of these guns. The New York Times recently profiled a representative from the company Armadix who makes one of these smart guns. And a store in L.A. had agreed to stock it, and then they yanked it. There was a huge outcry from gun rights advocates. What do you make about the market for smart guns?
Well, I do think that the marketplace is really where we're seeing a lot of our battles over gun control move to. With absence of legislation and Congress and whatnot, the battles are now whether people are going to be able to bring their guns into Starbucks and Target. And for the gun rights people, what they're protesting is gun dealers that they think are not helping the Second Amendment. And so they've a long history of gun advocates who are both shooters and gun enthusiasts boycotting companies or stores that sell things that they don't like as a way of exercising their right to protest in the marketplace. So I think we're seeing consumers on both sides of this issue really take to private businesses and try to push through consumer demand for policies that they agree with.
That's been the argument from the National Shooting Sports Foundation. They said that the market should speak for itself. That's one of the reasons that they think we haven't seen smart guns take off, and others reliability of these weapons. But is it fair to say the market is speaking for itself, or are we hearing from the people who might want these smart guns? Are we only hearing from the people who don't?
Well, the truth is the people who don't want smart guns may be a very significant segment of the consumer market for them. Even though there's 320 million guns in America, and there's seemingly almost 20 million added to our stockpile every single year, it's a very decreasing percentage of the population that owns guns. And it's just that people are more collectors. They now have multiple guns. It's much more of a hobbyist kind of activity. Those are the people who are going to be the main purchasers of guns. So maybe they're just not willing to buy this kind of technology. I think over time, though, if the technology is reliable, if the technology comes at a good price, there will be demand in the marketplace for this among homeowners who have children.
Well, one flag that Second Amendment advocates have raised is whether or not this technology is actually reliable, that you need a gun to fire when you need a gun to fire. You can't afford a technology blip. Is the technology, do you think, ready to go?
You know, it doesn't. I have not seen enough studies to know whether it's ready to go. Armatex is saying that it's ready to go, but we just haven't seen enough of it to go forward to know whether it's really ready to go. I think it will have to have a high degree of reliability for many gun owners who are going to want to know that their firearm can be useful in a moment of great stress and great need, and not to have to fudge with technology. But, you know, I think what we've seen generally with regards to technology are improvements such that they become more reliable than the people. Hey, we'll be driving Google cars soon. Maybe having a Google gun isn't so far-fetched.
Right. Well, let's talk about that technology angle, because technology has made huge inroads into so many aspects of American life these days. Why do you think it's been a much, much tougher sell when it comes to guns and gun rights people?
Well, part of it is that it is a group that is resistant to certain kinds of technology. They've been resistant to technology that they think will sort of lead to either more gun control or, like in this particular instance, the way that it will lead to confiscation or effective disarmament of the civilian population. One thing you've got to realize when thinking about the gun debate and the perspective of gun rights advocates is that many of them really are convinced that the government is going to come take away our guns, if not today, then tomorrow or the next day. And they want to make sure that laws aren't put in place today that'll make that easy for the government to do tomorrow. So they fight against background checks, for instance, because they're worried that it'll lead to a government registry of everyone who has firearms, and then those guns will come and be taken away. And with regards to the smart technology, there's concern that if you require all guns to have smart technology, the government's either going to confiscate the guns that are currently out there, or use the technology in a way that will effectively disarm gun owners. And that is a belief that I think many gun owners are very sure of and very convinced of. And so I think that helps shape their perspective of how they see this kind of technology.
So is this the argument that it's sort of a backdoor way for the government to pass gun control?
Yeah, and I don't even think they'd say it's a backdoor way. It's a frontdoor way. It's a requiring that guns, it's literally the government controlling the functionality of a firearm. That's what they're fearful of. Again, I think that fear is probably overblown, but we'll have to see how this technology develops. If the technology is developed in a way that is safe, efficient, and effective, then you're going to see gun owners moving to it, and there'll be some gun manufacturer out there, some startup that's willing to make a name for itself, that will go out and try to sell these guns. That's how the marketplace works. I'm sure it'll work in this instance, too.
We're talking about smart guns right now and why they've been a hard sell for gun rights groups in America. Our guest is Adam Winkler. He's a professor of law at UCLA and the author of Gunfight, The Right to Bear Arms in America.
And we want to hear from you. Do you support this idea? Do you like the idea of a smart gun that can recognize that it's the owner or not trying to fire it? If you're a gun owner, would you want to own one of these smart guns? If you're not a gun owner, would this address some safety concerns you have and lead you to buy one of them? Should there be government mandates that guns should be smart, or do you fear exactly that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about the smart gun, a gun with user recognition capabilities that manufacturers hope can address things like suicides, accidental deaths, and stolen weapons. It's been an uphill battle for smart guns in the United States with opposition from gun advocacy groups. We're talking about the issue right now with Adam Winkler. He's a professor of law at UCLA and the author of the book Gunfight, The Right to Bear Arms in America.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think smart firearms are the wave of the future, or a bad idea that we don't need? Are you concerned about the Second Amendment, that maybe once guns with high-tech safety features go on sale, government mandates could follow? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post over at the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go to our phones right now, take our first call from Mark in Eau Claire. Hi, Mark.
Hi, my name is Mark. Oh, you already said that. I'm on both sides. I see both sides of it. I'm the guy who is anti-government being able to control the guns at all to protect yourself from the government. But then on the same token, if you have kids in the family that are they're on medications and that for obviously anxiety issues and whatever else, I don't like the idea of the ring, because if that ring is off or something like that, someone else can steal, or they can take that gun and put it by the ring and still commit suicide by you. But if it's a fingerprint, or the goal is to somehow find a way that can be controlled. But it also puts a fear on, now the government knows you have that gun, they could track you down because they know where that gun's at, because it has whatever it has inside that gun to be tracked. So then they know they can find you, whether you have that gun or three or four other guns, they can pinpoint exactly where you're at inside the home. So that's a concern. So anyhow, any questions?
Right. Yeah, no, a lot of great points there, Mark. I'm going to see what our guest has to say about some of that. First of all, I want to ask, Adam, is Mark right about the technology that these guns have, some kind of tracking GPS in them, or is that not true?
Well, it depends on the technology. There's so many different smart gun technology. It's really an overarching term used for a lot of different kinds of weapons. I mean, it dates back to 40 years ago. There was a firearm where you had a magnet in a ring, and just if the magnet was touching the trigger, it would fire. If not, it wouldn't fire, and that was a smart gun. And that, of course, wouldn't have any government tracking that would be possible. But there is the possibility in some of these technologies where it's working on some kind of radio transmitter or proximity sensor, where there may be something that could be hacked. That's at least the concern. We really haven't seen any evidence that they have been hacked, but we really just don't know, because the technology is still in its infant stages, despite in some ways being around for over 40 years.
And we're also hearing from some ambivalence, obviously, from Mark there. He's got some interest in it for safety measures, for people in the home not using the gun accidentally or for a suicide. On the other hand, wondering if the technology is actually going to work and be reliable. How does that ultimately get resolved?
Well, I'm not sure that it's going to get resolved in the near term any more than our other battles over gun control are going to be resolved in the near term. But I do think that over time, I think one of the important steps that we've taken is the Supreme Court in 2008 recognized that the Second Amendment does create an individual right to bear arms. That settles one of the biggest questions that was dividing Americans in certain ways. And I think as that ruling becomes over time more and more accepted, and it becomes more clear to many in the gun rights community that the government isn't coming to take away anyone's guns, then we're likely to see maybe a rosier future for gun control. Either that, or we'll have to see more political mobilization by gun control forces. So far, the mobilization has favored the NRA and the gun rights forces. The gun control advocates want to be stronger. They're going to have to do a better job at the polls.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, Mark. And let's move on to Chris in Rhinelander. Hi, Chris.
Hi there. I love NPR, love listening.
Thank you.
My comment to it is basically that I feel like anything that you add to a gun can be either taken off or dismantled, or say it's some sort of electronic, like you said, hacking. I was a marksman instructor for the Marine Corps. I know how you put just about any kind of weapon together and take it apart, and you can customize them any number of ways and modify them. So I just feel like this, it wouldn't quite work. I mean, if someone's determined enough, they can figure out a way around just about anything, and I feel like that's the case for this type of technology.
So would you rather see guns used as they are today without sort of branching off into technological smart features? You think it's better just to leave things the way they are?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I'm not really a big fan of gun control. But if we're looking for a way to cut down on violence and things like that, I feel like I don't know the way to, you know, make it stop or anything like that, but I don't feel like this is the way to make it stop. I mean, people, if they have the option to not buy one of these guns, they're not going to buy it. I mean, some people just, like the whole thing has been, they just don't want the technology around them. And I don't know the best way to make it effective, to make gun control effective, but I feel like this wouldn't really work just because there's got to be a way around it, and someone would figure it out eventually, and then it would become popular,
right?
I think.
Gotcha. Thank you, Chris. Thank you for your perspective there. And Adam, what do you say to that?
Well, you know, it's a very important point that we should recognize that there are some purposes for which a smart gun law may be effective and some purposes for which it won't be effective. I don't think it's really designed to limit the criminal misuse of guns, stop some bank robber who wants to get their hands on guns from getting his hand on a gun that he can't use. Obviously, the person's not going to go into the bank to rob the bank with a gun that he can't reliably fire. I think what the smart gun technology is about is providing an option for the family gun owner who's got children in the home to have a firearm in his house that he is more secure in the knowledge that his children will not get access to and use. And so it might be an effective tool to reduce accidents over time. Again, once so many of the quote-unquote dumb guns that are in existence aren't the ones being owned in all these homes. But so it can be useful, I think, for reducing the accident rate with firearms, but it's not going to do anything, as the caller rightly suggests, about criminal violence with guns.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. And Adam, so far the gun lobby has been very successful at putting the brakes on new gun control legislation. Ultimately, do you see technology, and maybe not this technology, maybe emerging technology down the road, doing what some politicians can't and just getting at the issue from a different angle?
Well, I think technology is going to be one of the most important issues with regards to firearm regulation in the next 20 years, which is interesting because the truth is guns haven't developed all that much at all that quickly over the last 400 years. You know, they've become so they can fire more quickly, and obviously that's become commonplace. But overall, the technology is very similar to what it was 100 years ago, 200 years ago. But we're seeing a real rash of new technology, not only the idea of smart guns, but also the possibility of people being able to make their own firearms through 3D printing technology. Another thing that's very much at its infant stages, but is almost certain to become very, very popular, and people will be able to maybe at some point print their own guns that work in a reliable fashion. What does that do to our background check laws or our other gun control laws? How does it make it more difficult? How do we make sure that those guns aren't going to be have sufficient metal or other materials that they'll be detected when they get through airport security devices? You know, it's going to be quite a big issue of technology and firearms regulation over the next few years, and smart guns are really just the tip of the iceberg.
See if we can get in one more very quick call. Dave in Ashland, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to point out before I get into the statement that I'm usually a very liberal person. All my liberal friends from Hollywood, I'm from Hollywood, pretty much hate my stance on guns. And my stance on guns is ultimately that you can't get rid of them. It's a bell that you can't unring. A gun is a tube, a propellant, and a projectile. I worked in special effects in the film industry and not long enough to know that anybody that wants to make a gun can. Now, I have kids. I grew up in a family with guns. My kids always had guns. They lived in Missouri for quite a while. And I understand the safety aspect of this particular technology, and I'm all for it. I'm not afraid that someone's going to try to take away my guns. I'm afraid that someone will try to legislate something to try to do that.
All right, and we're going to have to leave it there, Dave, because we're running out of time. Adam, your response?
Well, it's interesting. He does sort out those fears that he has. And that many gun owners really do have. And I think it's the reason why the marketplace hasn't really reacted as well to these guns. But, you know, the technology hasn't really been fully developed yet. I think there is no doubt that businesses, if they see that there's a possible demand out there in the consumer market for these firearms, as I think there probably is when the technology becomes reliable, they'll spend some time investing in trying to make that technology reliable. I think we're going to see more smart guns in the future, not fewer.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Adam Winkler, professor of law at UCLA and the author of the book Gunfight, The Right to Bear Arms in America. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk with a guest who's out to minimalize her life with a 33-item closet.
But first, 11 years after the U.S. invaded Iraq, the country is on fire as Sunni insurgents sweep into major cities, the death toll mounts, and citizens try to flee the violence.
How should the United States respond to the crisis? Yesterday, Secretary of State John Kerry acknowledged that airstrikes on Iraqi targets are under consideration. No answer will probably be an easy one as the administration faces criticism at home and abroad, and the baggage of the 2003 Iraq invasion continues to stir up emotions.
To walk us through the options on the table is Mike McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent at Huffington Post. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, today, British Prime Minister David Cameron has called the ISIS insurgency the most serious threat to Britain's security that there is today. How serious a threat to the U.S. is ISIS politically and also in terms of national security?
Well, I think politically, it's an incredibly difficult issue. And you got a great illustration of that today at the microphones when the Senate leaders had their press conferences. Neither Harry Reid, the Senate Majority Leader, nor Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, had a course of action that they were willing to talk about or recommend. I asked Mitch McConnell directly what he thought the United States should do, and he said, well, I want to hear what the president has to say, because the leaders are going to go over to the White House, I believe, tomorrow and get some sort of briefing. And, you know, the only thing Harry Reid said was, well, we're not going to go back in there. We're not going to go put people and forces back in there. We made that mistake once already. So you get the sense from both sides that there is not an appetite to go back in, but you don't get the sense of what the solution is. And that has a lot to do with the politics here in the United States, I think.
Well, President Obama has ruled out troops on the ground in large numbers. Right now, there are troops on the ground. They seem to be largely there to protect the embassy in Baghdad. And with that off to the side, that seems to leave airstrikes as the option for now. What would the goal be with U.S. airstrikes?
Well, the goal with airstrikes would be to somehow, you know, degrade these forces, slow them down, stop them from taking over more land and more territory. I mean, recently they've taken over, I forget how much of the sort of banking system up there in the north, but you know, something like $400 million seized from the banks up there in Mosul. You know, I mean, that can all be funneled back in to, you know, fuel their operations. So, you know, I guess the idea would be use airstrikes, slow that down, don't let them build up their forces to be a more significant threat sitting there, sort of on the border, the Turkey near Iraq and Iran, where it's obviously pretty volatile to begin with.
And one of the problems with airstrikes, though, seems to be that the insurgents, the fighting, the fighters are mingled with civilians. So how does that get handled?
Well, that has been handled very poorly so far. I mean, in the places where we've used drones, for instance, in Yemen, in Pakistan, there's all kinds of collateral damage. And if you listen to a lot of the lawmakers who are mostly Democrats, but some Republicans, they look at that and they see, you know, creating new enemies as much as slowing down old ones. But, you know, again, that's another one where it cuts both ways, where you have people say, well, better to be, you know, costing a few extra of theirs than to have our boots on the ground. So is one of those cases where the politics aren't really that clean, although, I mean, you'll find more Republicans saying do more and more Republican or more Democrats saying be more cautious.
Well, let's get a little bit caught up on what's happening today. ISIS is supposedly engaged about 40 miles north of Baghdad. How would you describe the threat to Baghdad right now?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, I'm a little bit out of touch with that specific level of detail. But from what I've heard, there's a lot of fear. There are people fleeing. There are, you know, just sort of that tremendous level of uncertainty. And a lot of it depends on whether you're a Sunni or a Shiite, too. I mean, you've got a Sunni insurgency. So if you're a Shiite, you're going to be very scared, right?
And in terms of Baghdad itself, if the militants, the insurgents reach Baghdad and Baghdad falls, what's at stake?
Well, what's at stake is, well, obviously control of the capital. For the United States, we have that huge embassy and compound there. They would have to get all of that out of there. I don't know how you would defend that if you were surrounded by an offshoot of Al-Qaeda, a former branch of Al-Qaeda that even Al-Qaeda occasionally distanced itself from these days. It would be extremely difficult. And, you know, what do? You just blow it all up? I really don't know the answer to that. I asked Senator Jay Rockefeller, who used to head the Intelligence Committee and was very involved in the original vote to go into Iraq. And I, you know, what do you do now, Senator? And he was like, well, right now there's nothing good to do, and probably the best thing to do is leave it alone. He thought that it was really much more of an internal issue and that they'll eventually work it out, and you certainly have to be on your guard. But he thought going back in or getting more involved or firing, you know, airstrikes and things like that may actually make it worse.
And why? What's the feeling on that? Why would that be?
Well, because it's fundamentally a conflict within Iraq, a sectarian conflict within Iraq. And having the United States come in, which is seen as an enemy by many people there, Shiite and Sunni alike, only complicates the issue in terms of sort of explaining how the world is sort of looking at the place, because you've got bombs going off, and as you said before, it'd be a lot of the killing would be indiscriminate. It wouldn't be clean. It couldn't be surgical, even though they use that phrase. So you end up creating more problems on both sides than you would necessarily solve. Now, that being said, he was very aware of the potential of it becoming another sort of Afghanistan where you have a bit of a haven. He didn't seem to think that would necessarily happen, but he was ready to admit that was a possibility.
Now, back here stateside, President Obama has been criticized for having a hand in all this, for not negotiating a stronger U.S. presence when the U.S. officially withdrew. How culpable is the president, do you think?
Well, I think it's hard to lay too much blame on the president. Al-Maliki, the current leader there, has sort of run a... the word partisan keeps popping into my head, up here on Capitol Hill, but it's really much more, he's been sort of dedicated towards the sort of Shiite side of things, and he has not brought the Sunnis into the government. So, you know, if you're Obama and you can't cut a deal with this person who is sort of got his own agenda, you know, how much is that your fault? You know, how much of the blame does one half of the negotiation get? Especially when you were picking up where your predecessor left off. You know, you can probably level some of the blame on him, but I would imagine that you probably want to go back to the folks who started it all before you start blaming the guy who tried to clean it up.
Well, one question on the table right now as the U.S. considers its options is, should the U.S. coordinated efforts with Iran? Iran seems to be willing. How do you expect to see that unfolding?
You know, I laughed when I first heard that. They were meeting on the nuclear issue, and then they had a little side meeting on Iran, or on Iraq with Iran. And, you know... you probably have to deal with whoever you can to try and prevent the situation from becoming as bad as some people fear it might be. And if that happens to be Iran, well, then you talk to Iran. I mean, it is a little bit ironic that considering all the heated verbiage flung Iran's way that now we might be in a position to need them to control a situation that's getting out of hand in Iraq and in Syria.
Now, in our last minute here, Mike, in a piece you wrote for the Huffington Post yesterday, you analyze how the rationales for going into the 2003 Iraq War have changed over the years. Tell us what you found.
Well, you know, if you remember back to 2002 and 2003, it was all about we need to stop, you know, the next Hitler from arising and using weapons of mass destruction to destroy the United States or harm our allies. Well, you know, as we all know, no WMD were found, and Saddam really didn't seem to pose all that much of a threat. So folks are now, mostly folks who want to blame Obama for the way things are now, are saying that 4,500 Americans died to liberate Iraq. Well, yeah, I mean, in effect, they did, but they didn't go there to do that. They went there to go stop Iraq from being able to harm the United States, even though that was a phantom mission. So it's a little interesting to find folks sort of ignoring what it was all started for and then coming back so they can blame Obama for wasting all that effort.
And we're going to leave it there. Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks for having me on.
That was Mike McAuliffe, senior congressional correspondent at Huffington Post.
Our next guest decided to streamline her life by taking up minimalism. She started with her closet and launched the 6-week, 33-item closet project. She went through a wardrobe, pared it down to 33 things to see if her life felt easier to manage and to be less paralyzed by choice.
Allison Sherwood joins us now. She's an interactive lifestyle producer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Allison, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, what made you decide that this 33-day challenge, paring down your wardrobe items to 33 things, was a good idea?
Well, when I first came across a blog post writing about the benefits of having a small wardrobe, at first I was kind of like, no, I don't think I want to do that. No, I don't think I could do it. But as I started to think more about the idea of making life easier by, you know, limiting your choices in the morning and focusing only on clothes that fit you well, clothes that you like, and things that mix and match well together, I started to think, this could be interesting. So I wasn't really sure how it was going to go when I started, but I thought I'll give it a try and blog about the process and invite readers to do it along with me. And just my goal is to make life easier, but also just see how it changes my perspective on things, not just style, but contentment, being happy with what you have already, and materialism. And society kind of puts a lot of pressure on women, especially, to have a vast wardrobe and to wear a different outfit every day and to look perfect. And so this is kind of an experiment in seeing, can I be okay with just a few things that I really like, and will that make life easier?
You've been doing this now. Are you okay with it?
So far, I have been. I really have been enjoying it so far, and it has made life easier. There are the moments when I look in my closet and I only see a few things hanging there, and I kind of think, oh no. But once you realize you only need one outfit to wear today, then it becomes a lot easier. And it's all the things that I included in my wardrobe are things that I wear all the time anyway. I know a lot of us have tons of clothes, but then we wear the same outfits over and over because those are the things we like the best. So this is kind of just removing all the other things that I don't wear anyway and focusing on the things that I do.
So 33 items, what does that include and what is accepted?
It includes clothes, accessories, jewelry, shoes, purse, sunglasses, coats, although thankfully it's summer, so I don't have to worry about that. But yeah, anything that you wear outside the house. I didn't include workout clothes or undergarments or pajamas or just sweatpants that I'd wear lounging around the house, but stuff that I would wear to work and wear outside the home.
And the rest of the clothes went right in the dumpster, right?
No, I just moved everything into our guest room closet. So now that's, you know, exploding with the rest of my clothes. And hopefully this will help me eventually get rid of a lot of stuff. Another thing I want to do is just prove to myself that I can live without the things that I don't wear that all that often, because I do have a hard time letting go of things. I'll keep it because I might want to wear it someday, or I think that I'll need to wear it at some point. So by getting it out of sight, hopefully at the end of these 6 weeks, I'll have an easier time of going through and removing things that I don't really need.
You've invited your readers from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel to come along on the journey with you. What have people said about their experience?
Yeah, it's been really fun hearing from readers. There are people not only from Milwaukee, but I've heard from readers all over the world, all over the U.S., who are interested in this or who are doing the challenge along with me. And it's cool to hear how we all have our own reasons for wanting to do this. One person I talked to, is her husband's in the military, and so she's moving, their family's moving every 3 or 4 years, and so she's really minimizing everything in her house and in her life because they don't want to move it across the country with them. Other people have gained a lot of weight or lost a lot of weight, and so their clothes just don't, a lot of their clothes don't fit them, so they want to focus on just curating a wardrobe that they're comfortable in for their body right now. Or there are people who, you know, on the other hand, don't know what is essential in their wardrobe and want to focus on investing in some pieces that they're going to get a lot of wear out of. And so they're trying to figure out what they should wear for that. Or there's people who are doing it just to save money because they shop too much. And this is a way to say, I'm going to stop shopping for this amount of time. I'm going to focus on using what I have and see if I can get by that way. I've also heard from a few people who are hitting retirement and they're at a transitional stage in their life where they're kind of switching their wardrobe from a professional attire to more leisure attire. And so this is helping them kind of figure out what that wardrobe should look like and getting rid of the stuff that they don't use anymore. So there's a lot of wide variety of readers who are doing this, and it's really fun.
Have you heard from any men picking up the challenge?
Most of them are women. I have heard from women whose husbands are doing it along with them or who are already doing it. And I think, I don't know, I think a lot of us think it'd be easier for men since...
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll admit.
But I don't know. I went through and I counted my husband's clothes in his closet, and he didn't have as many as I did before the challenge started, but he still had a lot. I think that men have the same problem as women with getting sentimental attachment to clothes, and it might be something that
True.
they don't fit into or will never wear again, but they have an emotional attachment to keeping it, so that makes it difficult to get rid of things.
Well, Rob is a bit of a clothes whore, so this could be
yeah.
something that would fit your bill.
I did just purge some things, and definitely I will admit I did have things in that category of, oh, I used to really like that shirt when I wore it last 3 years ago, and I finally
yeah.
made that purge. So yeah, I could see guys getting into
yeah.
this.
I struggle with that a lot, and once I go back to my closet and try to pare down all the stuff that I've hidden away, you just have to keep in mind that the memory is in your mind, or you have photos of yourself in that outfit. It's not the actual piece of clothing that holds your memory.
And what have you noticed as your day-to-day life unfolds now that you don't have this, you know, 400-item wardrobe to confront you every morning? What's changed?
It is easier picking out clothes to wear. I can mix and match really easily. I've gotten a little more creative with the clothes that I've chosen, so that's actually kind of fun, putting together combinations that I might not have worn before. Laundry has actually gotten easier. I was really nervous that it was going to be such a pain having to do laundry more often than I normally do. I don't like doing laundry. Who does? So I normally just let it pile up for as long as possible and then have this huge load to do. And that takes a lot of time. But it's actually a lot easier to just do a small load weekly. And I've started just combining whites and darks and, you know, towels and whatever needs to be washed together, and doing a small load saves a lot of time. So, yeah, it's been another thing I've learned is that it's okay to wear the same outfit more than once before washing it, as long as it's not, you know, totally dirty. And even in the same week, if you're not going to see the same people that you saw when you wore it the first time, wear it a second time and nobody knows the difference. It's okay.
Allison, if you hadn't noticed, we're in Wisconsin. We have seasons. Do you get to pick out a new 33 when winter rolls around?
Yeah, well, this challenge that I'm doing ends on July 12th, and I'm not really sure yet what I'm going to do after that, if I'm going to continue and pick a different set of 33 items or what. But there are there is a popular challenge out there called Project 333, where people do a similar 33-item wardrobe, and they do it for 3 months and then switch it seasonally. And so they just kind of rotate through different seasonal 33 items, not even changing the whole wardrobe, but swapping in a few things here and there to make it appropriate. And I don't want to commit at this point to doing that, but it does, they're a part of, you know, that sort of is starting to appeal to me now that I've seen the benefits of wearing less clothes.
All right. Well, it's an interesting project. We'll have to see if you inspire anyone here on Central Time to try it. Allison, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Allison Sherwood. She's an interactive lifestyle producer for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.